SF 90.1 FM, जो कि बर्नबी, ब्रिटिश कोलंबिया में स्थित है.
Hi, my name is Lowell, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser Campus Radio.
Would you give me a beat?
CJSF 90.1 FM is the campus radio station for Simon Fraser University, located on Burnaby Mountain in BC, Canada. CJSF 90.1 FM, diverse, independent, yours. Check us out on SoundCloud or at cjsf.ca.
There is such broad agreement that Latin Americans, in fact the world, cannot be allowed to exercise sovereignty, that is to take control of their lives. It's the global analog to the fear of democracy within. Well, that's the threat of taking their lives into their own hands. And it had to be destroyed by terrorism and economic strangulation.
That's Noam Chomsky, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Noam Chomsky on taking control of our lives. On the occasion of Noam Chomsky's 96th birthday on December 7th, we are honored to broadcast for the first time this classic recording of a talk he gave in Albuquerque in the year 2000. Many of the issues he addressed then remain salient today. He says that the right of sovereignty is fundamental to the task of taking control of our lives. Since June 2023, Professor Chomsky has had health issues, but his lifetime of activism and scholarship continues to inform and inspire many the world over. Alternative radio would never have happened without him. And now, Noam Chomsky, taking control of our lives.
It's no exaggeration to say that the effort to take control of our lives is a dominant theme of world history, with a crescendo in the last several centuries of dramatic changes in human relations and world order. In the past year, the global issues have been framed largely in terms of the notion of sovereignty, that is, the right of political entities to follow their own course, which may be benign or may be ugly, and to do so free from external interference. In the real world, that means interference by highly concentrated power, with its major center in the United States. This concentrated global power is called by various terms, depending on which aspect of sovereignty and freedom one has in mind. So sometimes it's called the Washington Consensus, or the Wall Street Treasury Complex, or NATO, or the International Economic Bureaucracy, World Trade Organization, World Bank and IMF, or G7, the rich Western industrial countries, or G3, or more accurately, usually G1. From a more fundamental perspective, though it takes longer to say, we could describe it as an array of mega corporations, often linked to one another by strategic alliances, administering a global economy, which is in fact a kind of corporate mercantilism, tending toward oligopoly in most sectors, heavily reliant on state power to socialize risk and cost, and to subdue recalcitrant elements. So let me turn to the question of sovereignty. First, a general comment. Sovereignty is no value in itself. It's only a value insofar as it relates to freedom and rights, either enhancing them or diminishing them. And I want to take for granted something that may seem obvious but is actually controversial, namely that in speaking of freedom and rights, we have in mind human beings, that is, persons of flesh and blood, not abstract political and legal constructions, like corporations or states or capital. If these entities have any rights at all, which is questionable, they should be derivative from the rights of people. That's the core of classical liberal doctrine. It's also the principle, the guiding principle, for popular struggles for centuries. But it's very strongly opposed. It's opposed by official doctrine. It's opposed by sectors of wealth and privilege. And that's true both in the political and the socioeconomic realms. In the political realm, the familiar slogan is popular sovereignty in a government of, by, and for the people. But the operative framework is quite different. The operative framework is that the people are considered a dangerous enemy. They have to be controlled for their own good. These issues go back centuries, back to the earliest modern democratic revolutions in 17th century England, then in the North American colonies a century later. In both cases, the Democrats were defeated, not completely and certainly not permanently by any means. In 17th century England, much of the population did not want to be ruled by either king or parliament. Recall that those were the two contestants in the standard version of the Civil War. But like most civil wars, a good part of the population wanted neither of them. As their pamphlets put it, they wanted to be governed by countrymen like ourselves who know our wants, not by knights and gentlemen who do not know the people's sores and who but oppress us. These same ideas animated the rebellious farmers of the colonies a century later. But the constitutional system was designed quite differently. It was designed to block that heresy. The goal was to protect the minority of the opulent from the majority and to ensure that the country is governed by those who own it. Now, those are the words of the leading framer, James Madison, and the president of the Continental Congress and first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Jay. Well, their conception prevailed, but the conflict continued. They continually take new forms. They're alive right now. However, elite doctrine remains essentially unchanged. Fast forwarding to the 20th century, the population, and I'll keep here to the sort of liberal progressive side of the spectrum, gets harsher on the other side. The population are regarded as ignorant and meddlesome outsiders whose role is to be spectators, not participants, apart from periodic opportunities to choose among the representatives of private power. These are what are called elections. In elections, public opinion is considered essentially irrelevant if it conflicts with the demands of the minority of the opulent who own the country. We're seeing that right now, in fact. So one striking example, there are many, has to do with the international economic order, what are called trade agreements. The general population, as polls make very clear, is strongly opposed to most of what's going on, but the issues don't arise. It's not an issue in the elections because the centers of power, the minority of the opulent, are unified in support of instituting a particular kind of socioeconomic order. So therefore, the issue doesn't arise. The things that are discussed are things that they don't much care about, like questions of character or questions of reform, which they know aren't going to be implemented. So that's what's discussed, not what people care about. And that's pretty typical, and it makes sense on the assumption that the role of the public is the ignorant and meddlesome outsiders, is just to be spectators. If the general public, as it often does, seeks to organize and enter the political arena to participate, to press its own concerns, that's a problem. It's not democracy. It's what's called a crisis of democracy that has to be overcome. Again, I'm quoting, these are all quotes from the liberal progressive side of the spectrum, the modern spectrum, but the principles are quite widely held. And the past 25 years have been one of those regular periods when a major campaign has been conducted to try to overcome the perceived crisis of democracy and to reduce the public to their proper role of apathetic and passive and obedient spectators. Well, that's the political realm. In the socioeconomic realm, there's something similar. There's been parallel, closely related conflicts for a long, long time. In the early days of the Industrial Revolution in the United States, in New England, 150 years ago, there was a very lively, independent labor press run by young women from the farms or artisans in the towns. They condemned the degradation and subordination, I'm quoting, of the newly emerging industrial system, which compelled people to rent themselves to survive. It's worth remembering, hard to remember perhaps, that wage labor was considered not very different from chattel slavery at that time, not only by the workers in the mills, but right through much of the mainstream. So, for example, Abraham Lincoln or the Republican Party, even editorials in the New York Times that they might like to forget. Working people opposed what they called the return to what they called monarchical principles in the industrial system, and they demanded that those who work in the mills should own them, the spirit of republicanism. They denounced what they called the new spirit of the age, gain wealth, forgetting all but self, a demeaning and degrading vision of human life that has to be driven into people's minds by immense effort, which in fact has been going on over centuries. In the 20th century, the literature of the public relations industry provides a very rich and instructive store of instruction on how to instill the new spirit of the age by creating artificial wants or by, quoting, regimenting the public mind just as an army regiments the bodies of its soldiers and inducing a philosophy of futility and lack of purpose in life by concentrating human attention on the more superficial things that comprise much of fashionable consumption. If that can be done, then people will accept the meaningless and subordinate lives that are appropriate for them, and they'll forget subversive ideas about taking control of their own lives. This is a major social engineering project. It's been going on for centuries, but became intense and enormous in the last century. There are a lot of ways of doing it. Some are the kind that I just indicated, which are too familiar to illustrate. Others are to undermine security. And here, too, there are a number of ways. One way of undermining security is the threat of job transfer. One of the major consequences, and assuming rationality, one has to assume one of the major purposes of the mislabeled trade agreements. Stress mislabeled, because they're not about free trade. They have strong anti-market elements of a variety of kinds, and they're certainly not agreements, at least if people matter, since people are mostly opposed. But one consequence of these arrangements is to facilitate the threat. It doesn't have to be reality, sometimes it is, but just the threat of job transfer, which is a good way of inducing discipline by undermining security. Another device, pardon the technical jargon, is to promote what's called labor market flexibility. Let me quote the World Bank, who put the matter pretty plainly. They said, labor market flexibility has acquired a bad name as a euphemism for pushing wages down and workers out, which is exactly what it is. Nevertheless, despite the bad name, increasing labor market flexibility is essential in all regions of the world. The most important reforms involve lifting constraints on labor mobility, wage flexibility, as well as breaking the ties between social services and labor contracts. That means cutting the benefits and the rights that have been won in generations of bitter struggle. When they talk about lifting constraints on wage flexibility, they mean flexibility down, not flexibility up. And the talk about labor mobility doesn't mean the right of people to move anywhere they want, as has been required by free market theory ever since Adam Smith, but rather the right to fire employees at will. And under the current investor-based version of globalization, capital and corporations must be free to move, but not people, because their rights are secondary, incidental. These essential reforms, as the World Bank calls them, are imposed on much of the world as conditionalities for ratification by the World Bank and the IMF. They're introduced into the rich industrial countries by other means, and they've been effective. Alan Greenspan testified before Congress that what he called greater worker insecurity was an important factor in the what's called the fairy tale economy. It keeps inflation down because workers are afraid to ask for wages and benefits. They're insecure. And that shows up pretty clearly in the statistical record. In the past 25 years, this period of rollback of the crisis of democracy, wages have stagnated or declined for the majority of the workforce, for non-supervisory workers, and working hours have increased very sharply. They've become the highest in the industrial world. And this is noticed, of course, by the business press, which describes it as a welcome development of transcendent importance, with working people compelled to abandon their luxurious lifestyles while corporate profits are dazzling and stupendous. The Wall Street Journal, Business Week, and Fortune. In the dependencies, less delicate measures are available. One of them is the so-called debt crisis, which is largely traceable to World Bank IMF policy programs of the 1970s and to the fact that the third world rich are, for the most part, exempt from social obligations. That's dramatically true in Latin America and one of its major problems. The debt crisis is something, but we should be careful to notice what it is. It's not a simple economic fact by any means. It's to a large extent an ideological construct. What's called the debt could be overcome in a number of very elementary ways, largely overcome. One way to overcome it would be by resorting to the capitalist principle that borrowers have to pay and lenders take the risk. So, for example, if you lend me money and I send it to my bank in Zurich and buy a Mercedes and you come back and ask me for the money, I'm not supposed to be allowed to say, I'm sorry, I don't have it, take it from my neighbor. And if you don't want to take the risk of the loan, you're not supposed to be able to say, well, my neighbor will have to pay for it. That's the way it works in the international arena, however. That's what the debt crisis is. The debt is not to be paid by the people who borrowed it, you know, military dictators, their cronies, the rich and privileged in highly authoritarian societies that we've supported. They don't have to pay. So take, say, Indonesia, where the current debt is about 140% of gross domestic product. The money was taken by the military dictatorship and their friends and probably held by, you know, maybe a couple hundred people at the outside, but it has to be paid by the population under harsh austerity measures. And the lenders are mostly protected from risk. They get what amounts to free risk insurance by various devices of socializing costs, transferring them to northern taxpayers. It's one of the functions of the IMF. Well, similarly in Latin America, I mean, the huge Latin American debt is not all that much different from capital flight from Latin America, which suggests a simple way to deal with the debt, or a large part of it, if anyone were to believe in the capitalist principle, which is, of course, unacceptable, puts the burden on the wrong people, the minority, the opulent. There are other ways also of eliminating the debt, and they're recognized, and they also reveal the extent to which it is an ideological construct. One other method, apart from the capitalist principle, is a principle of international law that was introduced by the United States when it, what's called in the history books, liberated Cuba, meaning conquered Cuba to prevent it from itself from liberating itself from Spain in 1898. Having done that, the United States canceled Cuba's debt to Spain on the perfectly reasonable grounds that the debt was imposed without the consent of the population. It was imposed on, under coercive conditions. That principle then entered international law, largely at U.S. initiative. It's called the principle of odious debt. An odious debt is invalid, doesn't have to be paid. It's been recognized, for example, by the U.S. executive director of the IMF, that if that principle were available to the victims, not just to the rich, the third world debt would mostly dissolve because it's invalid, it's odious debt. But that's not to be. The odious debt is a very powerful weapon of control, and it can't be abandoned. For about half of the world's population right now, thanks to this method, national economic policy is effectively run by bureaucrats in Washington. That's another, also half of the population of the world, not the same half, but overlapping, is subject to unilateral sanctions by the United States, which is a form of economic coercion that again undermines sovereignty severely and has been condemned repeatedly, just recently again, by the United Nations as unacceptable, but makes no difference. Within the rich countries, there are other means of achieving similar results. I'll come back to that. But before doing so, just a word to about what we should never allow ourselves to forget, and that is that the devices that are used in the dependencies can be very brutal. Now, there was a Jesuit-organized conference in San Salvador a couple of years ago which considered the state terrorist project of the 1980s and its continuation since by the socioeconomic policies imposed by the victors. The conference took special note of what it called the culture of terror, the residual culture of terror, which lasts after the actual terror declines and has the effect of domesticating the expectations of the majority who abandon any thought of alternatives to the demands of the powerful. They've learned the lesson that there is no alternative, TINA, as it's called, Maggie Thatcher's cruel phrase. The idea is that there is no alternative to the, that's now the familiar slogan of the corporate version of globalization. In the dependencies, the great achievement of the terrorist operations has been to destroy the hopes that had been raised in Latin America and Central America in the 1970s, inspired by popular organizing. Throughout the region and the preferential option for the poor of the church, which was severely punished for that deviation from good behavior. Sometimes the lessons about what happened are drawn rather accurately in measured tones. So right now there's a torrent of self-adulation about our success in inspiring a wave of democracy in our Latin American dependencies. Now, the matter is put a little differently and more accurately in an important scholarly review, the major scholarly review by the leading specialist on the topic, Thomas Carruthers, who, as he says, writes with an insider's perspective since he served in the State Department Democracy Enhancement Programs of the Reagan administration, as they were called. He believes that Washington had good intentions, but he recognizes that in practice, I'm quoting now, it sought to maintain the basic order of quite undemocratic societies and to avoid populist-based change, inevitably seeking only limited top-down forms of democracy that did not risk upsetting the traditional structures of power with which the United States had long been allied. Almost accurate. It would be more accurate to say the traditional structures of power with which the traditional structures of power in the United States had long been allied. And that's accurate. He himself, Carruthers, is dissatisfied with the outcome, but he describes what he calls the liberal critique as fundamentally flawed. That leaves the old debates unresolved because of its perennial weak spot. The perennial weak spot is that it offers no alternative to the policy of restoring the traditional structures of power, in this case by murderous terror that left a couple hundred thousand corpses in the 1980s and millions of refugees and maimed and orphaned and the devastated societies. So again, TINA, there's no alternative. The same dilemma was recognized at the other end, the opposite end of the political spectrum, by President Carter's main Latin American specialist, Robert Pastor, who's quite far to the dovish progressive end of the admissible spectrum. He explains in an interesting book why the Carter administration had to support the murderous and corrupt Somoza regime right to the bitter end, and then when even the traditional structures of power turned against the dictator, the U.S. Carter administration had to try to maintain the National Guard that it had established and trained, and that was then attacking the population with the brutality a nation usually reserves for its enemy, as he puts it. Now, this was all done with benign intent under the TINA principle, no alternative. Here's the reason. The United States did not want to control Nicaragua or the other nations of the region, but it also did not want developments to get out of control. It wanted Nicaraguans to act independently, except, his emphasis, except when doing so would affect U.S. interests adversely. So in other words, Latin Americans should be free, free to act in accord with our wishes. We want them to be able to choose their own course freely, unless they make choices that we don't want, in which case we have to restore the traditional structures of power by violence if necessary. That's the spectrum, if you can tell the difference. There are voices that are outside the spectrum. Don't want to deny that. For example, there's the idea that people should have the right to share the decisions which often profoundly modify their way of life, not have their hopes cruelly dashed by violence, by foreign power, in a global order in which political and financial power is concentrated, financial markets fluctuate erratically with devastating consequences for the poor, elections can be manipulated, and negative aspects on others are considered completely irrelevant by the powerful. Those are quotes from the radical extremist in the Vatican, whose annual New Year's message could scarcely be mentioned in the national press. And it's certainly an alternative that's not on the agenda.
You're listening to Noam Chomsky on Taking Control of Our Lives. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online our website, alternativeradio.org.
Why is there such broad agreement that Latin Americans, in fact the world, cannot be allowed to exercise sovereignty, that is, to take control of their lives? It's the global analog to the fear of democracy within. Actually, that question has been frequently addressed in very instructive ways, primarily in the internal record, which we have, quite a free country. We have a rich record of declassified documents. And they're very interesting. There's a theme that runs through all of them. It's strikingly illustrated in one of the most influential cases, a hemispheric conference that the United States called in February 1945 in order to impose what was called the Economic Charter for the Americas. That was one of the cornerstones of the post-war world still firmly in place. The charter called for an end to economic nationalism, meaning sovereignty, in all its forms. Latin Americans, it said, would have to avoid what was called excessive industrial development that would compete with U.S. interests, though they could have complementary development. So Brazil could produce low-cost steel that the U.S. corporations weren't interested in. Crucially, it was necessary to protect their resources, as George Kennan put it, even if that required police states, he continued. The problem, but Washington faced a problem in imposing the charter, and that was clearly explained internally.